And now, live from the Daniel Scappin Studio, deep in the foothills of the North Georgia Mountains, it's Mike Malloy.
Well, hello, 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 everybody. Glad you could make it. Thank you for tuning in. It is Tuesday, isn't it? All day today. Tuesday, the 27th of March, 2018. This is church night's tomorrow. God. See what happens when you have your spine punched? That's all better. The punching part. Before I get into current political topics. There was a death on Sunday in Topeka, Kansas, of a woman who figures very essentially into current or contemporary American history. Her name was Linda Brown. She was the one whose father objected when this little girl was not allowed to attend an all-white school in her neighborhood. And the resulting Supreme Court case became one of the most transformative court proceedings in American history. That was the school desegregation case, Brown versus Board of Education. She was 75. She died Sunday in Topeka. There was no cause of death announced. I've got to share a little bit of this with you because this happened in my lifetime, and if you are over the age of 65, it happened in your lifetime too. It was Mr. Brown's father, Oliver, whose name is attached to the case, although the suit that ended up in the United States Supreme Court actually represented a number of families in several states. In 1954, in a unanimous decision, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that segregated schools were inherently unequal. This was the separate but equal bullshit that was being struck down. And the decision by the court ended decades of practice, not just in the South, but elsewhere. Linda Brown was born in 1943 in Topeka to Leola and Oliver Brown, according to the funeral home. Linda's sister, Cheryl Brown Henderson, and the founding president of the Brown Foundation, an educational organization devoted to the case, recalled that her parents and others were recruited to press a test case. Cheryl Brown said, quote, "They were told, find the nearest white school to your home and take your child or children and a witness and attempt to enroll in the fall and then come back and tell us what happened." The neighborhood the Brown family lived in was integrated. Linda Brown, in a 1985 interview, said, quote, "I played with children that were Spanish American. I played with children who were white, children were Indian, black children in my neighborhood," end quote. And her parents, by the way, were not dissatisfied with the school that Linda was attending. What upset her dad was the distance she had to travel to go to school. First to walk through a rail yard, then across a busy highway, and then get on a bus. Linda said, quote, "When I first started the walk, it was very frightening to me. And then when wintertime came, it was very cold. I remember that. I remember walking, tears freezing up on my face because I began to cry," end quote. And in an interview with the Miami Herald in 1987, she remembered that day in September 1950 when her father took her to the Sumner School. She said, quote, "It was a bright, sunny day, and we walked briskly, and I remember getting to these great big steps going up to the school." And, of course, the school told her no, she couldn't be enrolled. Linda said, quote, I could tell something was wrong, and he came out and took me by the hand, and we walked back home. We walked even more briskly, and I could feel the tension being transferred from his hand to mine. In its ruling, the Supreme Court threw out that so-called separate but equal doctrine, which had allowed racial segregation in the schools as long as students of all races were afforded equal facilities, which, let me add parenthetically, was total bullshit. The court said, quote, to separate them from others of similar age and qualifications solely because of their race generates a feeling of inferiority as to their status in the community that may affect their hearts and minds in a way unlikely ever to be undone, end quote. You understand? The Macon little kids, back then, today, whenever, forcibly attend a segregated school, not because, I said forcibly, there are a lot of black parents now who've had enough bullshit with the white education system and have elected to form charter schools, black academies, black kid academies, where their kids can go and get a good education without have to dealing with white bullshit. But forced segregation is something entirely different. Anyway, by the time of the court ruling, Miss Brown was already in an integrated junior high school. She later became an educational consultant and public speaker. Now, her family was among several that reopened the original Brown case in 1979. I don't know if you remember that. I do. And they argued that the job of integration in Topeka, Kansas remained incomplete. And the case resulted in the opening of several magnet schools. As for her role in the landmark case, Linda Brown came to embrace it, if reluctantly. She told the newspaper in Topeka, quote, sometimes it's a hassle, but it's still an honor. Linda Brown, Brown versus Board of Education, passed on Sunday. Okay. Coming up next hour, I have some other news from the world of American Negroes, since we're talking about that period of time. So stick around for that. This cracks me up. I forget where I heard this discussion the other day. It wasn't centered around the Supreme Court justice, but – and I don't know if it was discussion between Kathy and me or several other people. I have no idea. But a retired Supreme Court justice, that would be John Paul Stevens, wrote in a New York Times op-ed published today, quote, the demonstrators, the kids, on Saturday, the demonstrators should seek more effective and more lasting reform. They should demand a repeal of the Second Amendment. Yes. Yes. The idea that the people of the United States have a right to arm up the way you would arm up a company of Marines is bullshit. It just is. Now, that is not to say that if people want to go buy a gun and can meet the qualifications that should be in place to own a gun. Now, by gun, I mean revolver, rifle, shotgun, but not a military-style anything. And the way the National Rifle Association has perverted and twisted and destroyed and ruined the Second Amendment completely. It was never intended to say that everybody should own guns. It was intended because Washington couldn't – the framers were afraid of a standing army. Oh boy, they can see things now. Because they figured a standing army was a threat to this new democratic republic they were trying to set up. Or no, I'm sorry, this new republic they were trying – it wasn't democratic at all. This new republic they were trying to set up. And a standing army would be too much of a temptation to a demagogue to use that army against the people. So What they had in mind was the right of the people to keep and bear arms at every, kind of like Switzerland. Of course, Switzerland's different. They, I don't know if the rule is still in place, the law is still in place in Switzerland, but at one time, the head of every household in Switzerland was mandated to own a machine gun. Switzerland, who hasn't been in a war in what, 700-800 years? If that. And back in the late 70s, early 80s, there was an ordinance passed in a town here right outside of Atlanta, Kennesaw, Georgia. There's a mountain there, Kennesaw Mountain, with a big Civil War battle. And the mayor and the city council of Kennesaw, they look like they just stepped out of the Beverly Hillbillies. I kid you not. The city council there passed a law that said the head of every household in Kennesaw had to own a weapon. It was a law, had to own a gun. Of course, it didn't make it through the Supreme Court. The state Supreme Court said this is bullshit. But going back to the framers, it's clear that they had no idea of weapons that are available now, military style or not. They had no idea of a goddamn revolver. They didn't exist. Multiple shot shotgun didn't exist. Multiple shot 22 rifle didn't exist. You know what existed? Muzzle loaders. Black powder, cap, firing cap, mini balls, M-I-N-I, mini balls, wads that you had to you had to stuff all this down. I fired one of these a couple of times, and I mean, a well trained soldier, civilian soldier, could fire and probably reload if the thing didn't go off in his face. Could fire and reload. Probably within 3 or 4 minutes. Now, maybe somebody in 1997 set a record for loading one of those things. I'm talking about back then, the late 18th century. Revolution. Well, not a revolution. War of Independence. And over the years, the NRA has so totally perverted that idea. I know a lot of us have said many times, okay, a strict reading of the Second Amendment, then you stupid shits use the weapons that were available when it was written. Because these guys were not seers. They didn't have crystal balls. Could see that a 30-clip magazine with a semi-automatic military assault rifle would even exist. They didn't exist. Sons of bitches. Former Justice Stevens argues that the amendment, which states a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. That whole thing was born out of the concern, what I just said, that a national standing army might pose a threat to the security of the individual states, and it's a relic of the 18th century. In 2008, Stevens was among four dissenters in that 5-4 decision by the Supreme Court in a landmark case. It was District of Columbia versus Heller. And that decision held that the Second Amendment protects an individual's right to bear arms for self-defense. And they didn't put any limit on it. Why doesn't the head of every household own a flamethrower? Or 15 or 20 landmines to salt around his or her property? Anyway, Stevens said that decision, the one in 2008, I'm quoting, that decision, which I remain convinced was wrong and certainly was debatable, has provided the NRA with a propaganda weapon of immense power. Overturning that decision via a constitutional amendment to get rid of the Second Amendment would be simple and would do more to weaken the NRA's ability to stymie legislative debate and block constructive gun control legislation than any other available option, end quote. Can you imagine the shitstorm that would develop if an attempt was made to remove the Second Amendment? I don't even know what kind of procedure to delete an amendment. I know it has to happen to add an amendment, but to delete one, I don't know. And the hundreds of thousands of people who participated in Saturday's anti-gun violence marches all over the country did not call for an outright repeal of the Second Amendment, as Justice John Paul Stevens is suggesting. But the right-wing fuckwads on right-wing radio and television, you know who the culprits are now insisting that the demonstration was a gun grab. And they're insisting that because the people who will hear them insist that are a bunch of dumb shits who don't have the intelligence of a gently stewed rhubarb stalk. But they hear these assholes on Fox or Breitbart or 4chan or whatever filling their heads with bullshit. Alex Jones is the premier bullshit tosser in America. He makes Trump look like an honest man. That's how bad Alex Jones is. But anyway, Stevens wrote, quote, that simple but dramatic action would move Saturday's marchers closer to their objective than any other possible reform. It would eliminate the only legal rule that protects sellers of firearms in the United States, unlike every other market in the world, and it would make our school children safer than they have been since 2008 and honor the memories of the many, indeed far too many, victims of recent gun violence. And meanwhile, of course, the assholes, like I just said, say that the weekend demonstrations were, their word, an attack on the Second Amendment. You stupid assholes. And David Hogg, remember that kid, a Parkland survivor and one of the organizers of the March for Our Lives? He criticized the television assholes on Fox for painting him as anti-gun. This is what David said, quote, they made it seem like I'm trying to take away people's guns, that I'm against the Second Amendment. My father is a retired FBI agent. I have guns in my house. I'm not against the Second Amendment, end quote. And Cameron Caskey, another Marjorie Stoneman Douglas student, made a similar point on Fox News Sunday. He said, quote, we are not trying to take everybody's guns away. My father was a reserve police officer. We have guns in our house. They're responsibly managed and hidden from anyone but him. The point is, we are not trying to take away everybody's guns, and the NRA wants people to think that. They are fearmongers. They want to sell weapons by exploiting people's fears. So the second we want to put common sense resolutions on these assault weapons, the NRA will say, they're trying to steal every single one of your guns, and people believe them. Fortunately, the majority of Americans see past this. Well, Cameron, I hope your assessment about the majority of Americans is correct. We need the Second Amendment like we need another asshole, if you'll pardon the expression. We don't need it! There is a well-regulated militia necessary to the security of the state. What the fuck is that? We have nuclear bombs now. We have tanks. We have massive artillery.
Ballistic missiles.
And these NRA fucks keep telling people, well, they're going to take your guns away. Then what are you going to do? You know, Hitler took the guns away. Jesus Christ. I'm so tired of this. I am so tired of this. All right, moving on. This is a piece I found in Environmental Defense Fund. And I missed this. I did. I missed this entirely. Something amazing happened in Washington last week. Trump's shit trail. Trump's filthy goddamn entire life, his fucked up family, all this stuff clouds everything out. We know this. But here's what happened. Congress rejected, if you can believe this, Congress rejected Trump's cuts to the Environmental Protection Agency's budget and a host of other critical federal programs. And in the end, the dumb shit had no choice but to sign the 2018 federal budget into law. Now, as the EDF points out, none of this could have happened without a groundswell of activism. Tens of thousands of citizen petitions and phone calls over the last 13 months, pounding away on lawmakers. We didn't do this. We didn't do this. Many of them, these lawmakers, face challenging midterm elections and the political risk of gutting the EPA. For these assholes proved too much. They couldn't use their own common sense, their own rational minds. Oops, they have neither. To figure out that the Environmental Protection Agency, the second word there is protection. And they couldn't figure out that the majority of Americans would like to have the environment protected. And the lives of their children and themselves and granny and grandpa. So it wasn't Congress that saved the EPA. It was individual citizens of the United States. Sam Perry, writing for the EDF, said, quote, my organization alone collected more than 125,000 signatures from people opposing Trump's plan to slash 30% of the EPA's budget. Over the past year, public opinion polls have consistently shown that Americans support clean air. Oh, what a revelation. And water safeguards. Oh, no, really? We don't want piss and shit floating in the lake where we want to take our kids swimming? Gosh, who would have thought that? And that the vast majority of Americans oppose the idea of a decimated EPA. So let me go on with this. This is kind of interesting. Congress listened. And this will mean less pollution, healthier kids, and in the stark terms of Washington calculations, a greater recognition that attacking environmental safeguards is bad politics, not bad life, not bad exposure to wonderful things. No, none of that. Bad politics. Okay, whatever it takes to motivate these useless bastards in Washington. Now, Sam Perry points out that it's a genuine moment for celebration, but a reminder that this fight must go on. Because this rat fucker, Scott Pruitt, the EPA administrator, is still aggressively pursuing an agenda to undermine his own agency's work. He recently bragged to the Heritage Foundation, another one of these fascist goddamn organizations supported by the Kochs and the Mercer family, that he, Scott Pruitt, wants to add hurdles to using sound science at the EPA. This is the leadership class in America right now. Can you? I mean, seriously, this is the leadership class. A bunch of liars, wife beaters, cheats, whore masters, sons of bitches, ignoramuses, and people like Scott Pruitt. All that other was, what's his name? Trump. Anyway, last week, budget showdown isn't going to stop Trump and Pruitt from trying again. But for now, Sam Perry is saying we should celebrate Congress. I'm sorry, Sam. I'll go along with everything except to that point. Here's what they did. They added $66 million to the Superfund Toxic Cleanup Program. The Trump administration wanted to cut it by a third. So they kept it intact and added $66 million. Second, they kept a funding level of $228 million for state and local air quality management. Well, how ridiculous is that? As if we all breathed, as if. Trump had requested a reduction of 30%. You need 30% less clean air than you're breathing now, is this fucking Trump's, or whoever put it in his head. It also maintained last year's funding of $14 million for lead program in states. Trump's budget proposed to take that down to zero. We've gotten lead out of the bloodstreams of all of us, pretty much. Although if you had a blood test now looking for heavy metals, you would find traces of lead. Me too. But at one time with, do you remember ethyl gasoline? Ethyl, wasn't that, you know, like Lucy and Ethel. Leaded gasoline, remember that? Remember the fucking fight that the car manufacturers put up? We can't take lead out. Or the engine will not then invent a converter. What's it called? Analytic converter? Catalytic converter. Invent that and put that in the car. Whoa, raise the price. Who the hell cares if it raises the price? We're talking about our bloodstreams. God. The Congress added $12 million in funding to grants fighting water pollution from the Long Island Sound to Gulf of Mexico and Lake Champlain. Trump had called for reducing those to zero. Yeah, see, when Trump wants to go swimming someplace, he doesn't go to these Gulf of Mexico. He doesn't go to Lake Champlain. He gets on his big-ass jet and goes someplace and, you know, fuck the little people. I hate this man. The bill also fully funded the Integrated Risk Information System that Scott Pruitt was planning to dismantle. That program supports researchers studying public health dangers from pollution and chemicals. Why would Scott Pruitt, this fuckwad, why would he want to eliminate programs that studied the public health dangers from pollution and chemicals? Why would he want to do that? Is he a murderer? Yes, he's a fucking killer. He may not be a murderer. That's a legal term, but he's a killer. He's an incipient mass killer. Scott Pruitt, the head of the EPA. Because if these ideas of his were put into effect, people die. So what do you call that? The bill also increased U.S. Department of Energy funding. Ooh, what's his name? Rick Perry. It increased funding for the agency's Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy Division from $2.1 billion to $2.3 billion. Trump wanted to cut it by 50%. So, it's clear that members of Congress weren't ready to explain to their brain-dead constituents why they had voted for more pollution, dirtier water, scummier air. They just couldn't go home and have a town hall meeting and explain that. Gosh, what's so hard about that? Hey, we're going to make sure you have dirty air to breathe. Aren't you happy? Can I get... No? Okay. And Sam Perry concludes by saying, I hope Mr. Pruitt, EPA head, who likes to say his only job is to implement the will of Congress, is listening to what Congress just said. I mean, seriously, there are people running this country who want to dismantle it. They're like the Goths attacking Rome. They just want to fucking break everything to pieces, turn us into a useless shithole of religious fanatics and political fascists. Why? Because the people who are trying to look at Trump, what is he, 72? How much fucking longer is this man going to be alive? Just actuarially speaking. But the shit that he's doing, like the Supreme Court Justice Gorsuch, he'll be there for the next 30 fucking years. Trump's not going to live to be 103. And that's just one example. People like Scott Pruitt, who want to destroy environmental laws, who want to just rip everything up that's been carefully planted. They want to go back to the New Deal and rip the shit out of that. Take Social Security, smash it. Medicare, smash it. Medicaid, fuck them. If they can't afford medical help, let them die. If they're Christian, you'll go to heaven. Oh, God. Where's the ball? There it is. Oh, Jesus. Hey, let's do a break. Kathy, if you don't mind. And I want to tell you about some high schoolers in Wisconsin. You know, Scott Walker's little private fiefdom. I'll tell you that when we come back. So, in Wisconsin, there's about 40 high school kids who are using the start of their spring vacation to bring Saturday's wave of anti-gun violence marches to the hometown of House Speaker Paul Ryan, you know, Janesville, Wisconsin. What these kids are going to do is walk 50 miles from the state capitol in Madison. The group was approaching the halfway point on Monday in a four-day trek from Madison to Janesville. And the event is, they've named the event March for Our Lives, 50 Miles More. And it's being billed, of course, as a continuation of the marches and demonstrations on Saturday, in which hundreds of thousands of teens and others took part and took to the streets of D.C. and other cities nationwide. A student named Brendan Fardella, one of the 50-mile march student organizers, said he originally planned to spend his spring break in Florida with his family, but decided to join the march. Fardella, who's 17, said, quote, "Common sense gun reform will make us safer. I want to talk to Speaker Ryan about what we can do. The beach can wait," end quote. And in that $1.3 trillion budget passed by the Republicans in Congress that the orange asshole signed on Friday included a few little tiny little tweaks to current gun laws, federal gun laws, modest improvements to background checks, and grants to schools to prevent gun violence. I just goddamn hate that. I just hate that. Grants to schools to prevent gun violence. Aren't schools where we educate our young... Oh, never mind. Now, the kids in Wisconsin have a website, and on the website they laid out additional demands for Ryan, including that he would back legislation that would ban military-style assault weapons for civilians, impose a national four-day waiting period on gun purchases, and raise the minimum age to legally buy any firearm to 21. And this is where those rat fuckers at the NRA start screaming about these kinds of laws would deny 18, 19, and 20-year-olds their constitutional right to keep and bear arms. I mean, don't you just want to get one of those NRA members and just strangle him? You don't? Where's the ball? Ashley Strong. Ashley. A spokes chick for Ryan said in an email, quote, "The speaker respects those expressing their views. The House recently enacted new laws to keep children safe without infringing on constitutional rights." Isn't there something in the preamble to, is it the Constitution? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, all white men landowners are created equal, and are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. Among those, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now see if these demonstrating kids were fetuses, you know, that somehow leaped out of their mother's vaginas and dragged their mothers along by the umbilical cord. If the fetuses were hopping down the road demanding, what are they saying? I think they're saying they want a gun control passed. Oh, the fetuses say that. Oh, well, shit, yes, let's do it. What are they saying now? Mine wants to get back in the womb. Her feet are getting dusty. And it's cold out here. See, if it was a fetus march for gun safety, oh shit, it would have been passed by now. The speaker respects those expressing their views. Now, Ryan, like most of these cowardly sons of bitches in the U.S. Congress, was not in Washington on Saturday. He was out of the country on Monday on an official visit to the Czech Republic. He's the speaker of the fucking U.S. House of Representatives. Why do you suppose he was in the Czech Republic? And last month, he told a news conference that congressional Republicans were not interested in preventing Americans from owning certain types of weapons. No, we're not interested. Ryan said at the time, "We shouldn't be banning guns from law-abiding citizens." You dumb son of a bitch. a law-abiding citizen can go wacko and pick up a fucking gun and walk into a school and eliminate the lives of 20, 30, 15, 18 children. And prior to that crime, he, the white guy, was a law-abiding citizen. You dumb bastard. Ryan said, we should be focusing on making sure that citizens who should not get guns in the first place don't get those guns. And who would that be, asshole? That's not what the Second Amendment says. It doesn't say anything about crazy people, emotionally disturbed people, vicious people, people who commit spousal abuse, spousal violence. I don't like that abuse bullshit where it concerns spousal violence. The students who had gone about 20 miles by yesterday were spending nights on the road in schools. And they plan to arrive in Chainesville tomorrow. Now, do you suppose that good old Eddie Munster, this ignoramus, I don't know why media have tried to paint him as Paul Ryan as a bright man, a technocrat, somebody who understands government, somebody who is working for the good of the American people. Why have media done that? I guess in comparison to the people in Trump's cabinet, but they started doing this before this monster Trump showed up. Paul Ryan is nothing but an idiotic little shit who does exactly what the moneyed interests pay him to do. He doesn't give a shit about the people in Janesville or Wisconsin or the U.S. He doesn't care about that. What do they pay him? $175,000 a year? Shit. Any one of his lobbyists would give him 10 times that if he asked for it. Have I mentioned yet tonight how much I hate these people? How about Steve Mnuchin? The Treasury Secretary. Oh, my God. The one with his gorgeous old lady. Mnuchin looks like, I don't know, he looks like a rabid rabbit. He does. Look at him. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to come across as shallow and absurd, but I think that if Steve Mnuchin were not whatever he was before he became Secretary of the Treasury, that his beautiful, gorgeous wife, who likes to hold up flats of $1 bills and grin, I don't think she would have had anything to do with him. Because here's the thing you got to remember, just like Melania, these women have to wake up, if they're still sleeping in the same room or the same bed with their husband, they have to wake up every morning and look at these fuckers. Yeah! Pull the pillow over your head!
Why? What's the matter?
Because your breath stinks like rat shit. Pull the pillow over your head and you're ugly. And you don't have any hair, even though you arrange it.
So my favorite writer right now, Charles Pierce at Esquire. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin appeared in the customarily friendly precincts of Fox News on Sunday. Mnuchin was ostensibly there to defend the president's dithering last week over signing the omnibus spending bill sent to him by Congress. For the benefit of those who have been rationing or who have been vacationing in rationality, we remind you that the president took to the electric Twitter machine and threatened to veto the legislation because of something he saw on the Three Dolts on a Divan, his favorite morning television program. A divan? Divan? How do you say divan? Couch. Three Dolts on a Divan, his favorite morning television program. Those are the three assholes on Fox in the Morning or whatever it's called. Fox and Friends. Oh, that's so cute, isn't it? This made everybody nervous for about 20 minutes, his threat that he was going to veto it, until they all realized that Trump had the attention span of a flea. He then signed the bill because he will do whatever the last person to whom he spoke told him to do.
and his several fans went apeshit. So he fell into Twitter rage again, swearing he'd never sign such an abomination again and asking Congress to send him a line item veto to use next time. Oh, yeah, that'll happen, Donnie. That'll really happen. You with a line item veto? Not in a million fucking years. Not even from these assholes in this Congress. They may be assholes, and they are. But they're not totally crazy, and they know that you are. Line item veto. As was pointed out almost immediately, this is precisely the same asking for a line item veto as having Trump asking Congress to send him a poll tax bill. The line item veto was declared to be unconstitutional 20 years ago in the case of Clinton versus City of New York. The Clinton in question was President Bill Clinton, not Governor DeWitt Clinton. And boy, howdy, did President Bill ever attach himself to some bad ideas. Yeah, Clinton wanted this too. So when Mnuchin sat down next to Chris Wallace on Fox News Sunday, he did so in what should have been the full knowledge that his boss had drifted off to Fantasy Island again. It was not to be. The following ensued. Chris Wallace. That's going to happen next time. When the next spending bill comes up in October, they're going to be demanding parity as well. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but it is reality. Mnuchin. It doesn't need to be reality. I think they should give the president a line item veto. Chris Wallace. That was ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. Mnuchin. Well, again, Congress could pass a rule, okay? That allows them to do it. He doesn't know. Mnuchin doesn't know. No, that doesn't allow them to do it. Because as soon as Congress passed the bill, if they ever were stupid enough to do that, Mnuchin, there would be a lawsuit filed immediately to stop it. And when it got to the Supreme Court again, I'm sorry, even this neo-fascist Supreme Court would say, no, for their own preservation. So Mnuchin doesn't know, and worst, he doesn't care. Worst of all, he's sitting in the position he's in right now because he doesn't know and he doesn't care. He doesn't care about the country. He doesn't care about our Constitution. He doesn't care about anything that is outside that safety deposit box that he has for a soul. It doesn't need to be reality. That's what he said. It does. This is the Secretary of the Treasury. It doesn't need to be reality. In Steve Mnuchin's world, it never has to be. Well, where did Trump find these weasels and worms and Jesus, God. Kathy, may I have another break, please? Be back. Stick around. You know, one thing that we all should understand, whether we come to terms with it or not, we should understand it. Well, I guess what's what understanding is. Putting that John Bolton in, as Trump did as National Security Advisor after firing McMaster, suggests that Trump is preparing for the very wars that he promised to avoid during his campaign. Of course, he promised a lot of shit. Now he wants the military to pay for the wall. Although Mexico is going to pay for it, you lying prick. Anyway, yeah, they both start with M, military, Mexico, who knew, right? So, according to Shahed Gorishi, who's writing at this website called Jacobin, just like the religious political organization, the Jacobins, last Thursday, Trump moved one step closer to completing his preferred cabinet. He got rid of McMaster, who Trump called boring, and replaced him with John Bolton. Now, this is the same John Bolton, listen up, who wrote the foreword for Pamela Geller, that nutball's hate-filled book about President Obama. Bolton called on Israel to nuke Iran. He has urged United States to bomb Iran and North Korea. He abused assaulted a female U.S. Agency for International Development employee. He advocated on behalf of the NRA for more gun rights for Russian citizens and still defends the Iraq war. This guy is going to be National Security Advisor. Trump's other appointments have similar psychoses. Mike Pompeo, who is going to be our new Secretary of State, compared Iran to ISIS and called Iran, quote, a thuggish police state that is intent on destroying America? And then there's Gina Haspel, the torture lady who is set to take over the CIA. Her history of torturing illegal detainees under the Bush administration should be well known to you by now. She even destroyed the recordings taken of the torture. Got to hide the evidence. And meanwhile, John Kelly, that poor bastard, even though he is a racist just like Trump, his position, a little precarious as chief of staff, he's not just quite racist enough, I guess. This team, Shahed writes, constitutes a gang of evil. The anti-diplomacy, pro-torture, pro-war initiatives they have supported have cost God knows how many lives, created instability and war in the Middle East to the detriment of U.S. national security and international standing. Additionally, both Bolton and Pompeo have ties to hate groups that promote division here at home. No wonder Trump likes them. Also, some of the initial appointments belong to the same gang, including the appointment of Nikki Haley to run to be our ambassador to the UN. We got to take a break. Starting next hour, I want to talk to you about poor Melania Trump. I'll come back to these war hawks who are going to work with Trump to get us into war. Stay with me. We'll be back in a minute. Okay. I'm back. Hello. One of the things that Kathy and I have been talking about lately, just not in-depth conversations, but some chatter, is about Melania Trump and how much more of this she can stand. I mean, the woman that her husband screwed shortly after her son was born. Her pictures all over the papers, all over television, all over everything, the subject of editorials. I guess it's bad enough to have a spouse who cheats on you, but it's particularly upsetting, I'm imagining, for a woman whose husband, it turns out, has been lying to her ever since they got married. What? Yeah.
I just want to say, I mean, unless Melania is just a moron, there's no way she didn't know who she married. I mean, it's not like Trump married Melania and became a poonhound. You know, I mean, this guy was a champion pussy grabber for 30 years. He wasn't shy about it. He'd go on Howard Stern and talk about how many sexual diseases he should have by now and others. So she can't pretend, oh, I had no idea my husband was such an asshole. I mean, there's no way. You know, she had to know. So maybe they had a deal. Look, baby, you know, I'll put you on a golden toilet, but, you know, I'm going to fuck around a lot. Okay. I mean, I'm sure what she didn't know was that he was going to run this whole sham White House thing by her and make her trot out there and pretend to be First Lady and talk about cyberbullying. Yeah. You know, so she didn't plan, I think, on the public humiliation, but there's no way, unless, like I said, unless she's an idiot, there's no way she didn't know who she married.
Yeah, okay. I certainly would agree with that assessment. But on the other hand, I mean, when they got married, how old was Trump? 60-something or late 50s? Maybe Melania – see, I disagree. I think maybe she was ignorant of the fact that he was such a such an asshole where it concerns women in so many ways, the pussy grabbing comment, all that stuff. But what I'm getting at, you know, surely Melania knows, well, of course she knows, that her husband took a vow, and part of that vow is forsaking all others. Now, that you can interpret that, I guess, a number of ways. But and then again, I think, yeah, she probably knew of her husband's reputation in a vague sort of way. But isn't it true with women, and I'm not being a sexist here, but in so many instances, a woman thinks she can change a man's behavior, which is one of the reasons she marries him. Is that just nod, yes or no?
Maybe.
Well, see, my experience has been a lot different from that. I've known a lot of married couples, young, middle-aged, a lot of divorced people, and I've been interested in hearing what their story is. You know, how could you marry this bastard if you knew he was such a philanderer? I hate that word. And usually the answer comes back, well, I thought I could change him. I thought he had changed. I thought he had outgrown it. But that idea of a good woman being able to change a bad man is not something I'm coming up with. That's as old as literature. It's as old as the theater. So I think maybe that might have been part of Melania's idea. But this constant pressure from her husband and media of pushing all this ugly shit in her face, I wonder how she's protecting Barron, although Barron may not even be tuned into any of this because of the problems that he's dealing with. But the point Kathy and I were trying to make to each other, I think, is how does a woman who, whether we like it or not, is married to one of the handful of people on this planet who could blow up the entire planet, Donald Trump, the Electoral College gave the son of a bitch that power to have the power to blow up the planet, to destroy everything when he gets in one of his fucked up moods. That's how serious this is. I mean, we can talk about his, you know, his whoring around or whatever you want to call it. We can talk about his ignorance. We can talk about his stupidity, his lies, the fact that he's a filthy son of a bitch. But the fact remains, this filthy son of a bitch has more destructive power at his command, unless I'm sure, but by now, I'm sure that people down in the lower levels who are supposed to carry out a madman's orders have already decided, no, fuck no. If he comes across with this launch bullshit, we're not going to do it. That has to have transpired by now. So she's married to this freak, and I don't know how she puts up with it. It's one thing to have a prenuptial deal. It's something else to get whatever material bullshit that Melania has or will get from Trump. But is there nothing else there? I mean, is it all a contractual agreement other than the marriage contract? Is it just – anyway, Raw Story said that Melania – Trump's spokeswoman, Stephanie Grisham, has issued a statement about all this talk about the three women who are filing suit against him for sexual misconduct. Stephanie Grisham, her spokesperson, asked media to be careful with what Stephanie calls salacious gossip.
Okay.
Salacious gossip. And she apparently asked reporters to not use the name Barron Trump in their stories. Who's Barron Trump? Right? The son, right? He was an infant when his father conducted these affairs. But this young boy, Barron, who campaigned with his father a couple of times during the 2016 election, is named for one of Trump's lying names that he uses to fuck over people, whether literally fuck over people or steal, lie, cheat. John Barron is the name Trump picked. This unconscionable piece of shit even will use his own son's name in his sexual and financial and political lies and deceptions. Donald Trump, I mean, we all know he is a total sociopath. He has absolutely no respect for anybody, anything, any place, anywhere, anytime, anything, unless somehow it has a direct, complementary, ego-stroking relationship to him. If it's not about him, it's not about anything. Even to the point where this prick takes his own son's name. So I'll tell you what, spokesperson for Melania, if you want, if you want him to keep Barron Trump's name out, what about John Barron, huh? Here's Grisham's statement. While I know the media is enjoying speculation and salacious gossip, I'd like to remind people there's a minor child whose name should be kept out of the news stories when at all possible. Why don't you address that to the fucker that employs you, Stephanie? Jesus Christ, what a rotten bastard. All right, news from the wonderful world of African Americans. Louisiana will not charge the two police officers who shot and choked and tased Alton Sterling while he was on the ground with two cops, one great big fat obese son of a bitch who why are there so many fat cops? Don't they stay in shape? Apparently not. While these two white cops murdered this guy in a goddamn convenience store driveway, murdered him. State of Louisiana, Louisiana Attorney General Jeff Landry said that the officers, Baton Rouge officers, Blaine Salamone and Howie Lake, had good reason to believe that Alton Sterling was armed with a gun and was continuously resisting arrest. What the fuck are you going to do when somebody's choking you if not resist? And they thought he had a gun. Oh, you fucking liars. You dirty, rotten cop liars. God damn it. Louisiana Attorney General told a news conference, quote, our investigation has concluded that officers Lake and Salamone attempted to make a lawful arrest of Alton Sterling based upon probable cause. You lying bastard, is based upon probable race. That's what it was based on. It was this man's killing, along with God knows how many others, that helped start the Black Lives Matter movement, which these right-wing pieces of religious horseshit now try to turn it into something evil, just like they did with the Black Panther Party that was designed to protect, same thing, 50 fucking years ago, more than that, well, about 50 years ago. Black Panther Party came into being as a defense organization. These two white cops, They're the ones. I mean, everybody's seen the goddamn video. What do you need to see? What did this Louisiana Attorney General Jeff Landry, what the hell was he looking at? Was he looking at the same thing you and I looked at? Remember the big rhinoceros-looking white cop? He's down on top of him, pushing his fucking head like he wants to bury it in the tarmac? And he's got a gun? No, not Elton. No, not Elton Sterling. The cop. And then shoots him. You know, there's point blank range, but there's also putting a goddamn barrel of a gun on somebody's body and pulling the trigger. No charges, because the officers acted properly. Also, from the wonderful world of African Americans, we all know about body cams. We all know about audio video recordings now that a lot of police departments are insisting that their officers wear when they're on duty. But there's a couple little catches. In so many instances, gosh darn it, the officer forgot to turn it on. Or, oops, I accidentally turned it off right before I murdered the black guy. Well, I didn't murder him. I mean, he was resisting arrest. He kept ramming his goddamn neck into my fist. But in Sacramento, for Christ's sake, police officials there boast about the fact that all the cops have body cameras. And in an effort to improve the public's trust in the Sacramento Police Department, these video footages are released very quickly after an arrest that might be controversial, or even if it's not, it's released immediately. But the fatal shooting by police officers last week of Stephon Clark was, oh, here's a shock, an unarmed black man. Gosh, how did that happen? But the murder of Stephon Clark, according to NBC News, has, and I think this was on Nightly News the other night, the shooting of this man, the murder of this man, exposed a flaw in the effort to improve the public, the Sacramento public's trust of their police department, a little flaw. And it opened up a new front in the national debate over body cameras. And that debate is the officer's ability to turn off the microphone on the device. They can turn off the mic and leave the video going. But if they turn off the video, of course, the audio is gone too. But gee, how convenient. I guess he would turn off the mic right before they would say, "Nigger, I told your black ass to get on the fucking pavement." Maybe right there. You think? Body cam footage from these two white cops who shot Clark in a residential backyard after dark on March 18th includes the chase, with one officer shouting, "Gun! Gun! Gun!" in the mistaken belief that Clark was armed. And then the gunfire. The video also covers the aftermath as backup arrives and the officers walk to the street. During their exit, one officer says, "Hey, mute!" They're not talking to some guy walking down the street. Then the audio on both cameras goes silent. Well, the video continues to show authorities responding to the murder. Why the officers muted their body cameras is unclear. The police chief there, Daniel Hahn, said he couldn't explain it. Oh, really? You mean you didn't ask your employees, your cops? Why'd you turn off the body cam? Or the sound? Why'd you do that? Gosh, that's a hard thing to come up with. The police chief, he just didn't think to do that, I guess. Why did you turn off the audio? Well, I guess that is very complex and complicated to ask your officers why they did that. I mean, it requires two sentences, right? Maybe one if you want to use a comma. Anyway, the police chief there says he couldn't explain it. He also said there were, quote, various reasons, end quote, why officers would turn off their cameras' audio, but he wouldn't say if the Clark shooting was one of them. The muting, he said, would be part of his police department's investigation of the incident. Oh, for sure. For sure. Just like down in Baton Rouge. Just like in Missouri. Just like all over the fucking place. Just like in Staten Island. Yeah, we'll investigate. Just like in Baltimore. Detroit. Name a city. The unanswered questions about the muted camera has, as it always does, raised suspicion. Oh, those Negroes. Among Clark's family and the protesters who have criticized the shooting as an illegal use of force. Sonia Lewis, a cousin of Clark, said last week, quote, when I heard about the muted cameras, I felt it was intentional. You're muting something you don't want the public to hear what you're saying. And that means if you don't want the truth to come out, then all of it is a lie. Yeah, end quote. The family's attorney plans to file a wrongful death lawsuit. And Betty Williams, who's the president of the Sacramento NAACP, said at a news conference yesterday that she had demanded the police department share its protocol for muting body cams. You know, what are the reasons? What are the circumstances? What are the conditions under which you allow your cops to turn off the body cams or the audio? Just tell me. Is it right before you use the N-word? Is it right before you call him a motherfucker? Is it right before you say, let's take this nigger down and put a bullet in his head? That probably would be a good time to have turned off the audio. Now, the body cam policy, and I know I'm using the N-word. In context to this, if it offends you, go fucking somewhere else. I will use it when I think it's appropriate, like I use any racial or ethnic or religious slur. I use them in the context of how they're used against the people who are considered to be in those targeted groups. Now, the city of Sacramento's body cam policy, which is posted online, doesn't mention muting at all. You know, if you have a body camera that has audio and video and you turn it on, leave it the fuck alone. Why else do you have it? Tough questions. The body cam policy says that officers should record, quote, any enforcement or investigative activity until that operation has been reasonably concluded. The policy adds that officers may deactivate their cameras under some circumstances, including talking about confidential or tactical matters, or for privacy concerns, as long as the reason is documented afterward. Well, gosh, the chief of police in Sacramento is at a loss because he doesn't know why. Well, where's the documentation? The rule requires it. Well, just a black guy. Now, if we had shot a white guy, well, in the first place, we wouldn't have turned off our audio. These bastards. Cedric Alexander, former police chief in Rochester, New York, it says here. Where's this from? Yeah, NBC. Former police chief in Rochester, New York, former public safety director in DeKalb County, Georgia. We knew him. Said he saw nothing wrong procedurally with the Sacramento officers muting their cameras in the aftermath of the shooting. Attorneys would advise officers to do that, to avoid recording comments that could be used in administrative or criminal proceedings, according to Cedric Alexander. Turn it off to prevent the court, if it goes to court, from hearing the whole story. That's why he's the former public safety director here in DeKalb County, the former one. Now, in his defense, Mr. Alexander, who's a former president of the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives and a member of the Task Force on 21st Century Policing under former President Obama. He said that while the muting didn't appear to break any rules, it looks bad. It looks bad. Alexander said, quote, the problem is the optics of this, end quote. No, the problem is another unarmed black man was executed by white cops who then tried to hide the evidence, whatever the evidence is. At least the part of the evidence that might be contained in the conversation that nobody will ever know now. Jim Buierman, president of Police Foundation, I guess in Sacramento, said the muting of body cams does not appear to be unusual among American police officers. I wonder if anybody has done a comparative analysis of how many times the body cam or the video part has been turned off when the subject is the killing of a white guy or the arrest of a white guy as compared to the killing of a black guy or the arrest of a black guy. What do you think? You think it's equal? For some reason, I don't. Remember this guy, Mark Anthony Condit, the bomber, the white guy who was the bomber in Austin, Texas? Before he committed suicide. And he's not referred to as a terrorist. Could it be because of his skin color? Nah. Or his religion? He's a Christian. The Hill reports it this way. As details continue to emerge regarding his motives in the bombings, resulting in the deaths of two men, serious injury of a woman, it appears generous public deference is afforded this white male who grew up in an observant Christian family. Now, have you heard this guy referred to as a Christian? If he had been a Muslim, you would fucking know that before his body was cold. Isn't it funny how that works? Self-described in a chilling recording as a psychopath. That's what he called himself. This guy, for many, is undeniably a serial bomber who would likely have perpetuated his bombing campaign indefinitely if law enforcement hadn't closed in on him. Yet if his name was Muhammad and he was raised in an observant Muslim family, woo! Immediately, domestic Islamic terrorist! Here's a little stat for you. According to the budget for fiscal year 2018, the FBI spends $3.5 billion, or nearly half its budget, on counterterrorism. But not if it's a white Christian! And then the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security acknowledged in their 2017 Joint Intelligence Bulletin not only that white supremacist groups had carried out far more fatal attacks than any other domestic extremist group since the attack on this country on September 11, 2001. The FBI and the Department of Homeland Security promised they're going to commit more funds to the exploration of Caucasian Christian domestic terrorism, which is fucking rampant in this country. Do you not get that? Do you not get that? Nonetheless, the FBI uses the vast majority of its counterterrorism budget to focus disproportionately on the Muslim community. Why, of course, just like the Nazis did with the Jews, right? Huh? And specifically on observant Muslim males between 16 and 35 years old who have expressed discontent with American foreign policy where it concerns Muslim nations. And as we know, as part of that strategy, the U.S. government has taken this extraordinary step of trying to identify individuals who may be at risk, who might be at risk for radicalization by some crazed imam, I guess, right? Never a crazed preacher, a Christian, but a crazed imam. Future crime. We got to stop it. Seems to be the message. So how do you do that? Well, you put your spies in a mosque. God knows, not in an Orthodox temple, not in a fundamentalist Christian church, not among these evangelical devils who walk around just promoting this shit. Why don't you assign one of your counterterrorism officers to Franklin Graham, huh? The late, great Billy Graham's fucked up son. Why don't you do that? He has advocated terrorism against Muslims. Oh, well, he didn't come out and say, let's get terroristic against Muslims. But what's the statement right before that? The presumption that these young Muslim men are susceptible to radicalization is based, and here's the mind fuck for this for me, is based primarily on the fact that these young Muslim men, they're American citizens, have First Amendment protection in the exercise of religion or expression of political beliefs. Oh God, let's repeal the First Amendment. No, we're going to repeal the Second. I'll get to that in a minute. Or no, I did that last hour. Jesus Christ, my brain is flipping. Now, here's some more facts for you. The FBI utilizes a network of over 15,000 informants to target these individuals, even in the absence of any actual criminal conduct. I can't help it. It just reminds me of the brown shirts targeting the Jews in Germany in the 20s and 30s. No, the Muslims haven't been herded into ghettos yet, like the Jews were. The Muslims haven't had an official comparable Kristallnacht, like the Jews had to experience in Germany. But what the fuck is right around the corner? Ooh, can't predict that stuff. You can predict crime, but you can't predict that kind of crime. You can predict the crime, or you can attempt to, that these radicalized Muslim young men may commit, but you can't predict, if that's the right word, the crime that insane, fucked up white men will commit. Like walking into a church, a synagogue, come on, Mike, Islamic place of worship, mosque, damn it, couldn't think of it. I hate getting old. Or a theater or a rock concert. Why not? Where's the ball? Oh, here it is. Oh, shit. And reportedly, these informants are paid, or they're under so much pressure to deliver actionable intelligence, or they might be paid to do it, that they invent the very terrorism plots that the FBI later foils. How many times have you heard this about an informant will approach someone, determine that it's a young Muslim man, for example, or a young black man, for example, and say, hey, listen, you know, we know you've been putting up with a lot of shit. Wouldn't you like to get even? And the target might say, well, no, seriously, look how they're shooting black men down the street. Look how they're targeting Muslims. You know, I mean, there's spies all over the fucking place. Wouldn't you like to get some payback for all this shit? Yeah, that would be kind of nice, but I'm not going to break the law. Oh, no, you don't have to break the law. You have to break the law. You have a perfect right under the Second Amendment to have weapons, own weapons. Tell you what, I will get you 30 AR-15s And if you know anybody who would like one, why do you want to do this? I'm just an honest white man who feels that maybe your people are getting tired of being fucked over. Honest white man, huh? Yeah. I don't think so, man. I mean, you're talking about some mega death there. I mean, shit. What? Yeah. All right, I'll tell you what. I'll just get the guns, and you take a look, and if you don't want them, I'll give them back. Oh, man, whatever you want to do. I mean, where were you going to be tomorrow? I'm on this corner every day. What are you doing on the corner? Waiting for some white person to pick me up and get me some work? What are you doing on the corner? Oh, I just saw you here. You know, I thought, you know, you might be interested. I'll see you here tomorrow. So next day arrives. The informant shows up. Yep. He's got a SUV. And he brings the black guy around. He says, look, come here, look. Raises the back door. AR-15s all over the place. Just out of curiosity. Black guy reaches in and picks one up. God damn! All of a sudden, 30 fucking ATF, Homeland Security, FBI, CIA, on that man. Just on that man. And guess what he's charged with? Domestic terrorism. Kind of like the sci-fi movie Minority Report. Without the creatures that were lying in the pool, getting all the telepathic, precognitive messages, right? They haven't gotten to that point yet. I'm sure that's next. But it's not like that. This is a punitive measure designed to repress and control people in this country who fall outside the state's sanctioned speech and belief systems, whether they're religious or political. This fucking little podcast that I do in the program I do, this goddamn thing has been monitored probably for the past 30 years. And, I really don't give a fuck. I don't care now. Now, when they come knocking on my door some night or some afternoon, I'll probably give a fuck then. But right now, I couldn't care less. I always say, not always, but I used to say, hi, NSA, hope you're enjoying the podcast tonight. Now, go fuck yourselves, which is what you do best. Woo! The Intercept, you know, the online paper, maintains a real-time record of terrorism-based prosecutions across the country. And they report that of the 850 people prosecuted for terrorism since 9/11, the vast majority did not commit acts of violence. According to the Intercept report, this, quote, the few terrorism defendants had the means or opportunity to commit an act of violence, like raise the trunk of the SUV. Look at all these AR-15. God damn, man. The means or opportunity to commit an act of violence. The majority had no direct connection to terrorist organizations. Many were caught up in FBI stings in which an informant or undercover agent poses as a member of a terrorist organization. End quote, according to the report. Human Rights Watch produced a study in 2014, and this is part of what that study said. Quote, according to multiple studies, nearly 50% of the more than 500 federal counterterrorism convictions resulted from informant-based cases. Almost 30% of those were sting operations in which the informant played an active role in the underlying plot. How many times have we heard that? That an act that had the potential, excuse me, to lead to an act of terrorism, but never did, excuse me, was set up by the informant who then went on to play an active role in the so-called plot. Kathy, give me a break. I got the hiccups. I'll be back in a minute as soon as I stop hiccuping, all right? You know, and then to add a layer of irony to this piece I'm sharing with you, if any is needed, which it isn't, Muslims have reported in this country record numbers of hate crimes. In August of 2017, CNN reported an average of 9 mosques targeted monthly just last year, 2017. Now, stop for a second. If 9 synagogues had been targeted, what do you think the noise would be in this country about that? As well it should be. What do you think if 9 mega churches, Christian churches, were targeted for acts of violence? That'd probably get a lot of attention, and it probably should. What if 9 fundamentalist churches were targeted, Christian? It'd be all over the fucking newspapers, wouldn't it? But how many of these 9 mosque attacks just last year, not 9 for the whole year, 9 per month average? Let's see, that would be 104 mosque vandalism or bomb attacks just last year. How many of the 104 made the nightly news? And last May, this piece of human dreck, Jeremy Christian, what a name, huh? A white supremacist was charged with murdering 2 men on a train. Remember that in Portland, Oregon? Because this ignorant son of a bitch, Jeremy Christian, decided to murder 2 men who came to the defense of a young girl wearing a hijab, probably Muslim, she was a Muslim, who Jeremy Christian was verbally attacking. 2 guys on a train came to her rescue and they're now dead. A year ago, 2 Asian Indian engineers were shot and killed in Kansas by white supremacists after being mistakenly labeled as Muslims. Every white supremacist, every American Nazi, every American Klansman or woman is a Christian by definition. So as this white male down in Texas, what's his name? Mark Condit. He remained under the radar. He planned and executed murders in Austin, the capital, the second largest state in the United States. So while that's going on, fake terrorists and fake acts of potential terrorism are invented, prosecuted, and used to exaggerate the potential of an impending Islamic threat, just like the state of Oklahoma, and I'm sure other states have now too, passed laws by their legislature saying, we will never allow Sharia law to run the state of blank, fill in the blank. As if Muslims, who constitute such a small, unnoticeable, should be unnoticeable, percentage of the American population, as if they want to or even think they had a chance of imposing Sharia law, Islamic fundamentalist law, in the United States. And yet the white supremacists, the crazy fuckers, these Christian psychos, that's one of the pieces of the heart of their message. We got to stop these Mohammedans. Now, the woman who wrote this, is a native Oklahoman. What's her name? Huma Yazin.
Oh, that's not an American name.
She writes, as a native Oklahoman, the worst terrorist attack I experienced was feeling the ground shift beneath my feet as a 14-year-old. When Timothy McVeigh blew up the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, killing 168 and injuring more than 600. And that terror remains ingrained in me from April 19th, 1995. And it comes from the misidentification of the perpetrator. If you'll remember right away, the FBI was calling this the work of a Muslim. They even tracked a man who got off a plane in London, a Muslim from America, and brought him back. You know, what the fuck is going on? They're bringing him back to face charges of Islamic terrorism, killing 168 people and wounding more than 600. And after that embarrassing bunch of bullshit, they had to let him go. But good old Christian Timothy McVeigh. Who would have thought a white, male, Christian American would ever do something as horrendous as blowing up a building and killing 168 people, 30 roughly of whom were kids in a daycare center, for fuck's sake? No, white Christian males don't do that. Ooh. It had to be a Muslim. Couldn't have been a Jew. The Jews don't like violence. Not in this country, anyway. Had to be a Muslim. Americans, if you're interested in stats, have a higher chance of being crushed to death by their own furniture than killed in a terrorist attack. But why don't we ask the question why our money is being used to fund a reiteration of the now defunct counterintelligence program that was disbanded by the FBI in 1971. Well, the answer is very simple. The rise of the Christian psychotic right in this country, the rise of the white supremacist Klan-based Christian psychotic right in this country, that's where it's coming from. I mean, when's the last time you, dear heart, unless you're a fanatic white Christian Klansman who listens to this program to build your dossier on me, and if you are, swing on this. But when was the last time you were concerned about a terrorist attack, a Muslim terrorist attack? We're all concerned about the white Christian men who run around with fucking bombs and guns looking for people to kill. But when's the last time, no, seriously, when's the last time you sat down with your family and said, well, Ruth, we better be prepared for a Muslim attack today. I'm going to take my AR-15 to work. The writer mentions this. In 2007, five men were convicted of conspiracy to kill military members at the Fort Dix military base in New Jersey. And here we are a decade later, that continues to be praised as one of the most successful informant-based FBI stings. In the writer's research in reconstructing that 16-month-long sting, which consisted of more than 200 lengthy informant-generated wire recordings, hundreds of surveillance logs, over 300 FBI reports recording informant interactions, more than 10,000 FISA intercepted phone calls, I have discovered, she writes, why the prosecution failed to introduce one piece of direct evidence of a conspiracy. Because none existed. Months, 200 wire recordings, informant generated. hundreds of surveillance logs, 300 FBI reports, 10,000 FISA intercepted phone calls. Not one piece of direct evidence of a conspiracy. Now, as she points out, certainly national security threats from both domestic and transnational non-state actors is something, like ISIS, is something that we have to be aware of, something that should demand and get FBI and Department of Homeland Security's attention. Can't ignore the Sarnevs, the two Muslim brothers killed three and injured hundreds of Boston Marathon under the guise of their religious beliefs, granted. And we can't ignore statistics either. White males are far more likely to commit mass shootings, resulting in high death counts, than any other group. White American Christian males. What the fuck is wrong with them? Undercovering existing threats is essential, she writes, but fabricating new ones involving a would-be terrorist who lacks the means, the motive, or skill set, or money, or weaponry is not. Taxpayer resources, she writes, are best utilized to protect communities, including minority communities, you know, from the rising threat of white supremacy organizations, rather than criminalizing individuals on the basis of race, religion, political beliefs. So Huma Yasin, who wrote this, is an attorney, co-founder of Facing Abuse in Community Environments, and the author of the forthcoming book, Conspiracy, The True Story of the Fort Dix Five. And she's a Public Voices Fellow through the Op-Ed Project. And this was printed in The Hill. So you can get your own copy if you want. Speaking of forthcoming books, Kathy informs me that our partners in New York said that Chapter 8 is available now at the Kickstarter page. With photos. Huh? With photos? What photos did you send?
Some of the march.
Oh, yeah. There's a big section of Chapter 8 that's about the Civil Rights March in 87 here that I participated in. And there's some pictures from that. What else? Pictures of my immigrant grandparents?
No, you as a child.
Me as a child. Okay, well... BFD on that. But anyway, Chapter 8 is available. That's it for me for tonight. I'll see you next time. When's next time? What is today? Tuesday? I will see you Wednesday. In the meantime, take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.